If I said the phrase to you, the great Australian dream, most of you would know what I mean. In this country, that's what we call the dream of owning your own home. To own your own plot of land with a house that you can set up the way that you want, where you can do the things that you want to do. To have a place for your family and somewhere to call home sweet home. This passage we're looking at today from Exodus, the one that was just read, is about the people of God, a nation called Israel, who at the point in history that we're looking at, and the point in history that this passage was written, did not have any land of their own. At this point in history, the Israelites had just been rescued out of slavery in Egypt. They'd been captive in a foreign land, and now God's rescued them, he's brought them out, and they've got Moses as their leader, and God is telling them that he's now going to guide them to a new land, one that they can indeed call their own. It's going to be a very good land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a place where they will be blessed and where they can enjoy peace and prosperity. What we read here in Exodus 23 is part of the fulfillment of a promise that God made to his people much, much earlier in history. In fact, the idea of God giving his people a land to live in started back at the very, very beginning. In the beginning, when God made the first man and woman, he created a garden just for them. And the idea was that this was a place where God's people could live under his rule. It was a magnificent place, if you read Genesis, the perfect place for God's people to live. And for a while, the people God had made did worship him there and live with him there. Then, however, the people decided to rebel against God and to stop obeying him. The consequence was that God and people could not dwell together in that same way anymore, and so the people were banished from the garden. They lost the right to live in the land that God had made for them. Now, if that's all there was to the story of God, his people, and their land, then the Bible would be a very, very thin book. But that's not all there is, because God is a merciful God. And God, in his mercy, chooses a man called Abraham, and in Genesis 12, he makes three big promises to Abraham. He promises him many descendants, he promises him blessing, and he promises to give him and his descendants a new land. Here's a bit from Genesis 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing." So here God promises to restore things to how they used to be. He promises to give his people back a land, a place to dwell where he will be their God and they can be his people. In Genesis 15, a bit more detail is given about exactly which land this is going to be. Genesis 15, "On the day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, 'To your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites.'" So now God has even defined the borders of this land. He's identifying exactly which land it is. The promise is now taking on a geographically real place. The promise is taking shape. And if we move forward in time to Exodus 23, our passage today, Abraham's family has grown substantially, and they are now known as the nation of Israel. They're free from Egypt and they're marching through the desert towards their new home. However, as you can see by the Genesis passage we just read then, the land that God has given Israel is already inhabited by other nations. Now that potentially poses a problem because presumably these other nations won't be willing to just give up their land and their houses to the Israelites. They're not just going to hand their keys over and say, "Here you go." But listen to how God goes ahead of his people. Listen to how he promises to guide and to guard them, to go before them, paving the way to make sure that their mission into this new land is a success. From our passage from verse 20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces." So God is going to ensure the Israelites have success in their battles. He's going to fight for Israel and blot out any opposition they face. Israel is going to have God's mighty power on their side. In verse 27, I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. God is doing the winning here. It's not about whose army is the biggest when they get to the battle. God himself is going to use his supernatural power to make sure that his people get the land that he's promised. God is the one forging ahead, making sure of things, and Israel is following. And even look at verse 29. I will not drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. God is even going to control the speed with which the Israelites take the land so that the land remains in the best possible condition for them when they get it. He's going to drive the other nations out, but he'll do it bit by bit over time rather than all in one sweep so that the land isn't left unattended to spoil. God has every aspect covered. He will deliver his people to the promised land and establish them in it. And the way we're told in this passage that he's going to do that is through his angel. The passage talks about an angel that's going to guide and guard the Israelites so that they get to where they're going, to ensure that they take possession of the land and to ensure they're protected from their enemies. So who is this angel? Well, if we read back through Exodus, we see that this is not the first time the angel has appeared. The angel has actually already been involved in Israel's redemption. He was there at Moses' call at the burning bush. Here's a bit from Exodus chapter 3. Now, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, Here I am. So the angel appeared to Moses from the burning bush, we're told, but we're also told that God called to Moses out of the bush. So the angel appeared and God spoke. So hold that thought for a moment. We'll just jump forward to Exodus 14. The Israelites had just fled Egypt, and then Pharaoh does that thing where he decides he wants his slaves back again. So he sends his entire Egyptian army, hundreds of chariots, thousands of soldiers, out into the desert after Israel, pursuing them. And we read this in Exodus 14. Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. So the angel was leading Israel from the front, leading them through the desert. And then as danger approached from behind, he moved behind them, placing himself in between God's people and the threat. The angel performed the role of both guiding and guarding God's people as needed. And now in our chapter, chapter 23, we see the angel performing similar roles again. Verse 21, pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him. Verse 22, but if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. So God is saying, if you obey the angel, that is the same as doing what I say. To obey one is to obey the other, since the angel speaks God's words. One's voice is the other's voice. And God's name is in the angel, we read. That's how close they are. They're connected by name. The angel does God's work. The angel goes ahead in order to guard God's people from the enemy. He is their buffer and he's their shield going before them. So, what can we say about this angel from all that? What can we say about who he is? Well, there's no doubt there's an extremely close connection between the angel and the Lord, to the point that you can almost not separate them. The angel is a tangible manifestation of God's presence with his people. He's there to guide them and to guard them and to ensure they get to where they're going, to lead them into the promised land. God is working through and achieving his purposes through this angel. Now, the thing that must have excited Israel most about the land that they're about to receive is just how good it really is. We get a hint of that from our passage in verse 25, where it says God is going to bless their bread and water and take away their sickness in this land. But throughout Exodus and Deuteronomy, as more is revealed, we see that the Israelites, as they take over the land, it gets better. They will inherit cities and houses, they'll get water wells, they'll get vineyards and olive trees. The crops that they plant are going to thrive, food will be plentiful, people will be healthy and live a long time. In summary, life is going to be very, very good. I mean, think about the upside for the Israelites in all this. Not so long ago, they were slaves in Egypt. These people had been working for others and they'd been treated harshly. But now they're on the verge of working for themselves in this new land. We're reaping the rewards of their own labour rather than someone else getting it. These people who are currently living in tents in the desert are promised houses. Houses they don't even need to build for themselves because they're already there. All of them who are sick of eating manna in the desert are going to have fruit and olives to satisfy their taste buds. In fact, they're going to have all the food that they want. Women who had tried for years to conceive but couldn't can look forward to having children. Babies will abound and will live a long, full life. What a land this is going to be. What satisfaction and fulfillment there. It's going to be like Eden again, but now with a whole nation of people to enjoy it. How much they must have wanted this land and all that went with it. How much they must have longed for it, considering where they'd come from. And they were so close now, so close. And they had this angel to go before them. And the angel was going to go and make sure that they got the land. It was all set up for a future of blessing, abundance, and satisfaction. Now all of this, all of what we've said, is all part of the covenant that God established with Israel. But of course, every covenant is an agreement between two parties, and each side has responsibilities. And so all the Israelites have to do, now that all that's been set up, all they have to do as part of their part of the covenant is they have to obey God. They have to obey everything that the angel says. Israel must be covenant keepers in this too. They must be faithful. They must exclusively worship God. And as long as Israel obeys the voice of the angel and obeys God, they will be blessed, they'll go into the land, and they'll live long in the land. But if they violate God's commands, then all this will not happen. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a bit like an expanded version of our Exodus chapter 23 here. If you go and read it sometime, you don't have to turn to it now, but if you go and read it, you'll find 68 long verses of detailed explanation of how obedience will lead to blessing in the land, but disobedience will lead to curses. It fills out the detail about how if Israel is obedient, they will absolutely drown in blessing and good things, but if they are disobedient, they will miss out on all the good things that God has in store for them. And see, therein lies the problem, doesn't it? This covenant required the Israelites to uphold their end of the bargain. Now, the Israelites knew this, of course. It was made abundantly clear to them previously at Mount Sinai when Moses stood before the people with the law and he told them that they needed to obey God. The people's response was enthusiastic and they agreed that they would obey. Exodus 24, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words the Lord has spoken, we will do." And a bit later on, then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." The Lord has promised abundant blessing, and all the people had to do was obey him. But human sinfulness is such that the people couldn't keep their end of the covenant. They said they would, but they didn't. They tried, but they couldn't. And in the end, they just flatly refused. They wouldn't. In the end, their disobedience was horrific and blatant. And God even says of them in one part of Exodus, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people." Now, the people do enter the land, but their pride and their stubbornness and their desire to do their own thing stops them from receiving the full blessing. In the rest of the Old Testament, Israel suffers from invasion in the land. There's infighting, there's famine, disease, people die, and eventually the kingdom falls and other nations come in and take over the land once again. The blessings are never fully realised because Israel don't keep their end of the covenant. So what do we learn? Well, what the Old Testament teaches us is that man can never receive the full blessing of God if it depends on our faithfulness and our obedience. If God's angel came to us as a group right here, if he came to us and gave us the Old Testament law that we needed to keep to receive his blessings, then we would fail too, due to our sinful nature. We would miss out too. But you know what? God would never do that now. Why? Because in the person of Jesus, God has set up a new covenant, a covenant that can never fail because it does not rely on us. It's a covenant that we read about in Romans 3, which we've looked at recently. Romans 3, verse 21, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe." Jesus' life and his death and his resurrection is the basis of this new covenant. He fulfills the old covenant by being obedient to God all the time. And although he was righteous and didn't deserve to die, he obediently went to the cross and satisfied God's wrath, paying for our sin and disobedience. And then he graciously gives his righteousness to us. And so this is the hope we now have. The new covenant, that since he has been raised to life and gone to be with God in heaven, that we too will spend eternity in heaven, in that ultimate promised land, because Jesus has satisfied all that God requires. We look to Jesus and we put our faith in him because he has done what we could not do. We said earlier that the angel was a manifestation of God's presence with his people. Well, living this side of the cross, what can we now say? We can say that the most accurate manifestation of God's presence is Jesus himself, isn't it? Jesus walked on earth with his people. In Christ, God actually became one of his people and dwelt with them. There's no better manifestation of presence than that, of being Jesus being beside us in human form. And we know that Jesus has gone ahead of us and defeated the enemy, just as the angel went ahead of Israel. He has dealt with our sin and cleared a path to heaven and prepared a place for us there. We could say Jesus is our angel. Jesus is not an angel, but rather he's our angel in the sense that he perfectly fulfills the role of that Old Testament angel in the way that he leads us to the land that we have been promised. Not only showing us the way to heaven, but also making it possible for us to get there, securing a place for us there. And although Jesus is not on earth with us right now, he has given us his Holy Spirit. And it's the Spirit that is God's presence with us now, not only with us, but actually in us. His Spirit is our helper, our guide. He's our guide in this life as we wait for Jesus to return. He guides us into all truth. He guards us from the evil one, just as that angel also guarded Israel. If you've ever heard people say that Jesus fulfills the Old Testament, you've heard that phrase, but you're not really sure what that means, I hope you can see a bit of that from this passage, that just as the angel was the figure to lead Israel to the promised land, that Jesus will bring us to the promised land of heaven as we put our trust in him. So the promise of the Old Testament is accomplished, and it comes to its ultimate conclusion in Jesus and only in Jesus. And that's what it means for Jesus to fulfill the Old Testament. He's done the work. He's made it to heaven himself. He's prepared a place for us and will get us there too. Our life in heaven for eternity has been secured by him. So then where does all that leave us in terms of obedience then? The Israelites, they had big problems with obedience. We tend to have big problems with obedience. But if Jesus has done everything, if he's secured our place in heaven, does our obedience even matter anymore? Is it even an issue? Well, that's a question that the New Testament raises a number of times, and the answer is, of course, yes, it does matter. The pages of the New Testament are filled with encouragement to continue in obedience to God. Romans 6, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means. Present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. If we do have faith in Jesus, is there anything less for us to do? Yes, says James, there is. Faith without works is dead faith. So obedience does matter because it's the outworking of our faith. Obedience to God does not earn us his favour. We know that salvation comes down to faith in Jesus. But our obedience is going to be the manifestation of our faith. Obedience shows that our faith is alive and real. Faith and obedience go together. You can't really separate them. Our desire to obey shows that we are truly God's people. And you know, the essence of obedience really is worshipping God as the one true God. It's about serving him only to the exclusion of all other gods and all other things. This is a truth that carries through from Exodus 23, because as God led his people into the promised land, he knew other gods had been set up by the people who lived there previously. And he knew that if the temptation to worship other gods was in front of the Israelites, they might just turn to them. And that's why through the whole passage you see talking about them driving out the other nations and smashing down their idols and not having anything to do with or not taking any part in the practices of those other nations. The warning was there for the Israelites that engaging with other gods is playing with fire. Allowing themselves to be enticed by other gods is the sure thing that would lead them into disobedience against the true God, and it did. Verse 32 in our passage, "You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." Well, sinful humanity is sinful humanity. If we allow the gods of our day, the gods of comfortable living or early retirement or the chase for money or whatever the gods are that our world sets up that we focus on, if we allow these things to be our goal and our focus, then surely they will ensnare us too. So rather we put those things aside, because if we allow ourselves to be captivated by what they seem to offer, then we will forget that we're supposed to be following Jesus and listening to him. And of course, the more we chase those kind of things, the less time we have to consider our obedience to Christ and what he might want us to be doing with our lives. We know that following Jesus is not the easy life, but we know where we'll end up if we do follow him to the end. We'll end up in the true promised land, the one spoken of in the closing chapters of Revelation. I'll read a small section from Revelation 21 for you about this promised land. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away.'" That is what we have to look forward to: dwelling with God forever and being satisfied in him. No more crying or pain or sickness or death. Christ, our angel, has already satisfied all the requirements for entry to that land that you just heard about then, and he's preparing a place for us there. And if we follow him to the exclusion of all others, then we can be sure that we will end up there with him. Why don't I pray? Heavenly Father, we can see from as far back as the Old Testament that we cannot satisfy your requirements. We might be able to set up a house on this earth and make a home, but only Jesus can guarantee our life in your promised land of heaven. We give you great thanks for your mercy to us, and thanks for sending him. Lord, give us a willingness to serve you in all that we do, to the exclusion of all other gods, and to love you in response to what you have done. Amen.